Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Make sure you close the door so we don't get any outside noise. All right. Okay, Reg, you're where you belong in your seat. I'm where I belong in my seat. The levels are where they belong, just bouncing up and down, a little bit in the red there. So everything is set to go. All systems go for launch. We can start our countdown. Houston, are you ready? That actually ties into what I'm going to talk about today. Everything said here has a double meaning. Reggie, you know that. All right. I will give you the three S's, and then I will give that countdown, and we will have all systems go, and hopefully we'll have a great launch and a great flight for episode 227. So write that down on the book. Here are my three S's. Star, smile, and strong. And here's the countdown. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure at WGNradio.com. Yes, I know there is a problem again with the podcast getting posted to the other platforms where you usually down your podcasts. We know about it. They're working on it. I think it crashed again, even though it got fixed and we put up the missing podcasts. I know it all. I'm sorry. I have no control. I just provide the content. I send it to them and they do with it what they will. So they're aware of the problem. Hopefully it'll get fixed soon. But I appreciate your care and your worry and your anger. It means you care about this podcast, and that's great. Your loyalty and devotion is much appreciated, and you can still, even without it on those other platforms, you can still tell your friends, send them a link, send them a message, send them the good word that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. You can go to WGNradio.com and find this every Monday around 9 o'clock Central Time. I also post a link on my Facebook page, so I'm doing what I can. But once again, thank you so much for listening and caring. It means a lot. If you like what you hear, don't forget, go to the podcast section at WGNradio.com. Go to the Elton Jim prompt, and you can find all previous 226 episodes to catch up on all the podcasting we've been doing over the last 4.5 years. If you like what you hear in those 226 previous episodes, well, then I think you're going to enjoy this one, episode 227. Before we get started with the main thrust, that's a little hint as to what I'll be talking about soon. How about the Emmy Awards and the predictions that Emily Arminetti and I made about who would be the big winners? We basically said that Succession would do very well and dominate in the drama category, and we said that Schitt's Creek would dominate in the comedy category. Wow, were we right? But even we could not have predicted the clean sweep that Schitt's Creek performed in every comedy category in the Emmys this year. It had never been done before. I thought it would win Best Comedy and Best Lead Actor and Best Lead Actress. I didn't think it would win Supporting Actress and Supporting Actor and Directing and Writing. I think it won 6 or 7 Emmys. Every comedy category Schitt's Creek won on. That's amazing. Not only was it a little seen show, it wasn't a network show, it wasn't even a premium channel like HBO show. It was on Pop, the Pop Network, whatever the heck that is, and that's where I first started watching it. And then, thanks to the amazing reach and amazing power of Netflix, undeniable, undisputable, Netflix is the dominant entertainment company in the world, as for both a content provider and content creator. You cannot dispute that. Netflix, what a story. It started by sending out hard copy DVDs to people in envelopes. And now it is not only competing with, but it has overcome the major studios making films and certainly the major networks and other entertainment entities who produce programming. Netflix has surpassed them all in the last, 15 years? Starting from a DVD rental service through the mail. Wow. And it was because of the exposure on Netflix in the last year or so that Schitt's Creek even became exposed to everybody, and everybody started watching it. It was on this little scene cable network called Pop. It's a Canadian show. It produced and filmed in Canada. It didn't have any real big names. Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara certainly have a great pedigree from SCTV, but, they're older people. It's not the hippest thing in the world, you would have thought. So this small, relatively unknown cable network called Pop started showing Schitt's Creek about 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. But then when it got on Netflix, the world discovered it, and it went on to sweep the Emmy Awards in every comedy category. I mean, no comedy has ever done that. Not I Love Lucy, not The Honeymooners, not Cheers, not Modern Family, not Frasier, not All in the Family. Nothing. No comedy has ever done that in the history of the Emmys. Wow. What a role they were on. And we also, if you listen to the last episode, Emily Armonetti and I predicted that Schitt's Creek would do well. Never. As well as it did. No kidding. But we also mentioned Succession would do well, and that did well. It won for Best Drama, and it won for Best Actor. So, we did pretty well. Not too bad. So, congratulations to Emily and me, and to Schitt's Creek and Succession. Those are really the two of the main shows I watch, and once again, my taste is impeccable. Speaking of Netflix, I said, you have to acknowledge and congratulate Netflix as to how it has just developed into this major force in the entertainment world. And one of the things that that really tipped it over was not just providing all these shows online and streaming and really forging and introducing the streaming world. And now it's the most dominant or growing segment of the entertainment world, streaming. Netflix pretty much started it and put it on the map. But it was when Netflix created its own original programming, in addition to just having all these older programs on there, but when it decided to just do its own production and started with House of Cards and was able to draw in, Kevin Spacey, a two-time Oscar winner, to head up that show along with Robin Wright and other prominent actors, then when that show was critically acclaimed and you had to see House of Cards, then Netflix became a force. And it has never looked back. It has done a lot of great things in terms of producing some great movies and working with some of the most talented people in the business of show, like Martin Scorsese with last year's The Irishman, some great original programming, comedy specials. And they've really done a great job with documentaries. In fact, earlier this year, when the COVID pandemic first started and everybody was in lockdown, Netflix's Tiger King became the hottest show in the history of Netflix as a documentary. That thankfully has died down, and there's not so much Tiger King mania, but they still produce and show some of the best documentaries and really have helped elevate the entire documentary portion of entertainment. Documentaries used to be kind of the redheaded stepchild, the bastard child of the entertainment world. They're only for, you know, eggheads and overly smart people, and they would usually be crusading things and you know, be dedicated to a cause, and, you know, nebbish kind of people would only watch them and make them. They were a small slice, and he looked at it as very elitist, because a lot of times they did deal with kind of obscure topics. They weren't really mainstream. But the documentary has certainly become mainstream. It has become one of the more popular now genres of entertainment, and thanks again to Netflix, I think, for that as well. We also have to give props to Ken Burns, no question. I think Ken Burns and PBS over the last 15 or 20 years, when with his Civil War, his baseball, his Vietnam, his national parks, you know, those documentaries were made like feature films. They were compelling. They are compelling. He still makes them today. His Vietnam one was, I thought, one of the best he's ever done. The Civil War documentary obviously put him on the map. All of them have been great. I've watched them all. As I said, baseball, Prohibition, jazz, the country music one was just on about when last year sometime. I thought that was well done as well, and I learned a hell of a lot. So, yeah, you cannot forget about Ken Burns and people like Michael Moore, who started bringing the a higher visibility to the documentary with his Roger and Me, and then Fahrenheit 9/11, and Bowling for Columbine, and other documentaries. So certainly over the last 20 years or so, the documentary has risen in its prestige and its popularity. But once again, the Netflix is so prevalent in our society. Everybody is watching it, that when something gets on Netflix, it gains immediate acceptance, like Schitt's Creek did. So I have to say, I was very excited recently to see and watch and really enjoy, and I would recommend it to you, even if you're not a fan of space. From a historical perspective, whether you were born in alive in 1986 or not, you know, most history, you know, we were not around for. I hate when people say, well, that was before my time. That's the definition of history. It was before your time. And a lot of things happened before your time, and you need to know about them. And if documentaries can help you in that, from, you know, fill in some of the blanks that you didn't learn in school, then great. There's also something to be said for self-education. And just because you get done with school doesn't mean you can stop learning. And documentaries can certainly help in that. But I just recently watched a new documentary called The Challenger, The Final Flight. And it was quite an illuminating documentary. It was well made. It was informative. It was entertaining. It was dramatic. And it was very informative and very angering and frustrating and disappointing in what surrounded the Challenger explosion. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's called history. I believe January 28th, 1986, the Challenger space shuttle took off from Cape Canaveral in Florida, and upon liftoff, it exploded and killed all the astronauts, including the first civilian and the first teacher in space, Krista McAuliffe. And so this was a very high-profile space shuttle mission to begin with, because it was bringing the first civilian into space, and she was a teacher. And it was, it was a great moment to, honor the teaching profession and also show how far our space program had progressed, where we were now bringing in civilians. This was 1986. Don't forget, we started, in earnest space travel in the 60s. Obviously, in 1969 in July, we got to the moon. And what was interesting about that was once we got to the moon, we sort of got bored with going to the moon. And as amazing as it was to reach the moon, and the entire world watched it, and it was a great moment in American and in the history of man to leave, our atmosphere, our planet, and go to another, celestial body, Americans got bored. It's like, oh, they went, there were several moon landings after the original Apollo 11 with Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. But we sort of got blasé about it. And so that forced NASA to get creative because they were depending on, government funding. So they were trying to bring more attention to the space program, and they developed this space shuttle, which was a very complex but very initially exciting mission and vehicle, because the idea was that this thing could take off and then land like a plane and go to space on a regular basis. And the idea was it could carry cargo, because we were going to start to be colonizing and doing more things in space, and we would need to bring supplies and things to the space stations and different things. We may even have colonies on the moon or on different planets. And so the idea was this space shuttle to go back and forth to show how we had conquered space. And initially it was also a very exciting advance in the space program for NASA in the United States. But then we got bored and blasé again, like, oh, another space shuttle. And so that's why they opened it up to bringing in civilians, and they named Christa McAuliffe. So there was a lot of attention and a lot of publicity about this, because it brought attention to it. And wow, what a day that was. If you remember where you were on January 28th, 1986, you'll remember the shock and sadness of watching the Challenger explosion. And the entire story, it's in four parts, but they're not even an hour long. So we watched this in one sitting. It was so compelling and so interesting. I was just going to watch it maybe, over a course of 4 days or so, and we wound up watching it for 4 hours, under 4 hours, but all four episodes. They're about 45 minutes apiece. So it's on Netflix. It's called The Challenger. I believe it's called The Final Flight. And it really does a great job of telling the entire story. Some of the background that I just gave you about the space shuttle program and then leading into this specific mission with Challenger, it highlights all the astronauts who were on it. But most importantly and most significantly, it goes behind the scenes as to what caused this terrible malfunction and this horrendous explosion that led to the deaths of all the astronauts aboard. And it is angering, and the bureaucracy, the blindsidedness of or not even that, but wearing blinders, the importance of worrying about schedules and deadlines and pressures and expectations, and really putting human lives second in these decisions by a variety of different agencies. I'm not going to give it away, because I really want you to watch it. A lot of this, the facts came out after the explosion, and if you were around for that, you will remember the O-rings, at the very least. I hope you remember the O-rings. But you remember some key players, some key names of companies, and obviously NASA and the astronauts. And it's just well done. Some of the they talk to, some of the people are still alive, their families, and some of the people who made these decisions to send up this shuttle when there were clearly some major, major problems that NASA and other companies and agencies were aware of that had been around, that had been showing up on previous space shuttle missions. And yet, the need to stick to a schedule overcame the need to make sure that our astronauts were safe. And ultimately, what's so funny, they were all worried about keeping to a schedule. And of course, when it blew up, another shuttle didn't go up for 2 years. So your schedule was blown anyway. And, you know, crossing your fingers and hoping that the shuttle wouldn't explode didn't work. Saying prayers and hoping that the shuttle wouldn't blow up despite these deficiencies in the design that people were well aware of didn't work. You know, once again, hope and optimism is not enough. You have to be realistic on things. So I would urge you to watch this. And I tell you, I mean, I'm not a major space buff, but I am, have always been intrigued by it. I was a little kid when we landed on the moon. I remember it vaguely. I remember the hoopla around it. But I was probably, five? So I have memories of it, but vaguely. But I know my mom was really excited by this. And so was everybody. The whole world was captivated by this. And when, you know, it was shown live on television and Neil Armstrong, you know, stepped foot on the moon, I mean, it was one of the most historic days in mankind. And those of us who were alive for it when it happened, you just felt this sense of pride that you were able to live to see that. It was unheard of. And you think about when the Wright brothers first started flight. You know, it was under 100 years. We went from basically learning how to fly in a machine, you know, a few feet off the ground for a few seconds that the Wright brothers did. And now we were leaving the Earth's atmosphere and landing on the moon. Quite an accomplishment for human intelligence, ingenuity, and ultimately human ambition and drive to make that happen. Of course, you hopefully do know, once again, a part of history that John Kennedy in 1961 made the pledge that we would get to the moon before the decade is over. That's how he said decade with his Boston accent. We will go to the moon before the end of this decade era. And though sadly he was not alive to see it, we did get to the moon before the end of the 1960s. July of 1969. We were cutting it close, but we did it. See, folks, we actually can do things when we put our minds to it. Boy, this COVID thing drives me crazy. It's still out of control in people's behaviors, but I won't continue on that. But anyway, let's harken back to a day when American pride and American behavior and American ambition actually worked in a positive direction. We got to the moon. And so while I'm not a huge, you know, space fan, I never really wanted to be an astronaut. But sir, like I said, I remember vaguely the space landing. My mom, bless her heart, I've said many times, she was quite a pack rat, and she saved the newspapers and a lot of the magazines from the day after the space landing and magazines that were published after it, right after it. And I still have that. So I've got some of the original newspapers from, you know, now almost 50 years ago. Well, now more than, what am I talking about? Last year was 50-year anniversary. 50-year-old newspapers with, you know, the moon landing story. And some, you know, 8x10s of the crew. So once again, my mom was a pack rat. She saved a lot of stuff that was not needed, but in saving almost everything, she also saved some cool things that I never would have had that I do have still today. So certainly, being a part of that and growing up with the space race and the space program through most of my life, I've just been interested in it. But I have to say, I have a very, and as I said, if you were alive at that time on January 28th for the space shuttle, it is one of those days, I think, that you do remember where you were when you either saw it or you heard the news. Because it was the first, explosion and the first time that astronauts were killed in quite a while. Certainly in the early 60s, there were a lot of tests with unmanned spacecrafts that continually failed and blew up on the launch pad. And we did lose, some astronauts in the early days before we landed on the moon. And unfortunately, a loss of life and failures are a part of any complex kind of project. It's very seldom that you succeed on your first chance. And, you know, those people involved, certainly the astronauts, as well as all the people behind the scenes, all the engineers, all the politicians, all the heads of these agencies, all were aware of the dangers and the seriousness of this. But once again, it was the overriding sense of ambition and the feeling of wanting to discover and explore and achieve that many of the people, all of the people involved in our space program from the beginning realized the dangers, especially those astronauts who were basically sitting on, you know, tons of explosives. I mean, they're sitting, you know, on top of combustion. I mean, it's not that you just need to be, smart and experienced and a good, pilot to be an astronaut, but you've got to be, your bravery has to be through the roof because you have to know the dangers. And as much as time went on and space travel became kind of second nature and NASA was even trying to downplay the dangers and downplay the possibilities of failure and death and malfunction because it was this idea that we had really conquered this. Every astronaut, regardless of when they went up at the beginning of the space program until this moment, knows that it is dangerous and there is a chance that something can go wrong. It is an amazing feat. It is an amazing complex project to propel a craft with people in it to space. And so everything has to go right. And as we know, since we are humans, that doesn't happen on a regular basis. And it hasn't happened on every chance that we've taken. But we've certainly succeeded more than we failed over the last 50 years, if that's anything. So when the Challenger crashed in January of 1986, it was a shocking thing because, as I said, we had become so blasé to the space shuttle and space travel in general. And it was kind of promoted like, yeah, we've conquered this, no big deal, that we didn't even pay attention anymore. Space shuttle landings used to be on every network's, launches used to be on every network. This was big news. It interrupted your normal programming. We are going to space again. Certainly in the 70s it did. But in the 80s, after the first couple space shuttles, then we got sort of used to that again. And the space shuttles were not televised all the time. And they were not front page news. It became kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. And that's what was the case, as much, even though there was a lot of hoopla because of Krista McAuliffe being on the Challenger mission, being the first civilian and also a teacher. So obviously at her school and at schools around the country, this was a big deal. And it was being broadcast and simulcast to schools all around the country because it was a teacher in space. Right. So this was something big, but it, you know, at least in that thing. But for the average person, nobody was really watching. And I don't even know if it was shown live, you know, like on the networks. But I do remember where I was, and I do remember seeing it soon after the explosion happened. And talking about being in not the right place at the right time, because you're never in the right place for a horrible tragedy and a loss of life. So it's really not appropriate to say the right time and the right place. But certainly I was in a memorable place for an event, a historical event, a where were you when it happened event. I was fortunate to be in a an opportune place, put it that way. From a young age, I knew I wanted to be in the media, and when I went to college, I went to the college I chose because it had a radio station, and I knew that I wanted to get in some aspect of the media since I was 12 years old, and so I was fortunate enough to get an internship here in Chicago at WBBM Television, Channel 2, the CBS affiliate in Chicago. And I got a internship at the Channel 2 News, which had a great reputation here in Chicago as one of the groundbreaking local newscasts. And it was an exciting time because it had its heyday, Channel 2 News, in the mid-70s with Bill Curtis and Walter Jacobson as the lead anchors. And it also was a groundbreaker. It broadcast the news from the newsroom, not from a studio, but from the actual newsroom where the people were working. Sort of gave it that gritty, realistic view and realistic setting. And so between Channel 2 News here in Chicago being broadcast from the newsroom, a working newsroom, it also became very popular due to the gravitas and intelligence that Bill Curtis brought to a daily newscast, and to the scrappy and news-making reporting by his co-anchor, Walter Jacobson, who made a career from his perspective of keeping tabs on local government and embarrassing local leaders and local politicians if they were not doing what they were supposed to do. He was a trailblazer, and he was basically, there as a spokesman for the taxpayers, a spokesman for the little guy. And Walter Jacobson made a career out of that with his perspective, as I said. So Bill and Walter, as they were known affectionately, were very popular in the 70s. And then Bill went on to greater pastures, went to the network, in fact, and left Chicago. But by the mid-80s, he decided to come back. His network career did not take off as he had expected, I think. Chicago, when he left, and Walter was still on, and he went through a series of co-anchors, the Channel 2 News lost some of its luster in the late 70s and then into the 80s. And so in an effort to bring back that classic team and those ratings, because Channel 2 News was falling behind, both Channel 7, which took over, and it really has been a number one since the mid-80s, and Channel 5 here in Chicago, the NBC. So Channel 7 is the ABC affiliate, and Channel 5 in Chicago is the NBC affiliate. So in an effort to bring people back, they brought back Bill and Walter in the mid-80s. And so I was fortunate enough to, that was when my internship was there. In 1985, 1986, I was an intern for 6 months at Channel 2. And I was in the planning department, which means that there's breaking news every day, right? And so that is handled by the news desk. But there are also prepackaged stories that are not necessarily breaking on that day. And sometimes there is a news day that is filled with breaking news, and sometimes there isn't, but you still need to fill the newscast with news, right? So what we did in the planning department was we looked for stories that we would be happening the next day. We looked for interesting stories that we could follow up on and plan those stories so that if there wasn't any breaking news, we would still have news that was worth listening to and knowing about, but wasn't breaking at the moment. So we were planning ahead, thus the planning department. And that was a great department to be in. I was able to learn quite a bit about how news stories are put together, how you found a news story, how you judged a news story. Is this story worth doing something on? How do you pitch a story to your editor to make it sound interesting, the elements that you would need to make that story viable in terms of different sources and different experts or witnesses or the people that are involved in it, contacting them, letting them know you want to do a story, many times convincing them to do the story, putting all those elements together, finding what the news was, finding why this is important, putting it all together, pitching it to an editor. And then when it did get assigned, the reporter, you know, filling in the reporter on what they're looking for, they didn't know. They just said, okay, here's your story for today. And then they would come to you and say, okay, what's the story about? And you'd have it all written up, but you'd also talk to them, and then they'd go out and talk to those people that you spoke to the day before or a couple of days before and get the quotes that you needed and the information from them. And then they'd come back, and then they had to write it and edit it. It's really a very, you know, complex process. And so being in the planning department gave me a great insight into how to find news, to identify news, and how to tell a story. And I think the ability I have today to sit here and speak to you for an hour or so about different topics and different news and communicate hopefully that to you in a compelling way, I learned way back then when I was, you know, 21 or 20 years old. And so there I was at this beacon of, you know, Chicago news, Channel 2 news. And right in the thick of it, really contributing on a daily basis. It was a great learning experience. It was a great personal experience. And so I was there at a very opportune time, not just because of the space shuttle. I was there from September of 85 through March of 86. So 6 months. They're usually a 3 month thing, but they asked me to stay on an extra 3 months, so that was cool. And while I was there, I got a chance to see some amazing stories happen. Don't forget, this is September 85, which was the 85 Bears season, right? Their Super Bowl season, probably one of the best teams in NFL history. Bear fever captured the Chicago area as well as the nation from the first game. The year before, in 84, the Bears went to the conference final and lost, but you could see that they were a team that was destined, that they were very close. They came close to beating San Francisco. They showed that they were on a par and that they were ready to go to the next level. So there was a lot of anticipation in 1985 for the Bears, and certainly they lived up to it and made the Super Bowl. So I was there for that entire season, and then I was there for their Super Bowl victory and the Super Bowl parade. In fact, I was covering it and out there on the street helping out with the news gatherers at the parade. It was a cold day in January, but no one cared. So that was an amazing time, and that was an amazing time for our planning office because Bear Fever, you know, the newscast started with Bears stories. There, you know, if you were around during that 85 season, you remember that the whole everything in this city centered around the Bears on Sunday, and the whole week leading up to every Bear game, there was hype and anticipation about the next game. And so the newscast, not just the sports part of the news, but the regular newscasts were filled with anything Bears. The Honey Bears, what were those other the refrigeratorettes, the refrigeratorettes, was that their name? I can't remember. Remember there were some heavy set cheerleaders who then became popular. They were the anti-Honey Bears, but anything Bear-related. You know, after a Bear game, there would be Bears, you know, press conferences, and the Bears would make appearances around the city at different things, and you'd have to cover that, and, you know, people were doing Bears things. Everybody was wearing Bear paraphernalia. It was just Bear fever, Bear mania, and we were at the TV station were fueling Bear fever. We had our newscasts were filled with Bear stories. So that was a lot of what I was doing, was setting up a lot of those stories that you saw on Channel 2 News about different Bears related things. I was working on those. And so it was a great time to be to be in the news because everybody was watching the news because the Bears were just the story in Chicago, especially in 85 and 86. So that was a great time to be there. And then I actually, because of my internship at Channel 2, I was able to fulfill one of my great personal goals in my whole life. And if not for being there at that time, I doubt if it ever would have happened. I was at Channel 2 in 85, and Jackie Gleason, who was one of my all-time entertainment idols from the Honeymooner show, was in Chicago filming the movie Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks was an up-and-coming actor at that time, and he was in this very good film called Nothing in Common. Jackie Gleason played Tom Hanks's father, and Jackie Gleason was ill at the time, and it was very obvious. He died a couple of years after he made that movie of cancer, and you could see that he may have even been sick during the filming of that. And you could see physically that he was not well. And he played a great dramatic role in that film. But he was in town to film that. And there was a reporter for the Sun-Times who also moonlighted at Channel 2, well-known gossip entertainment columnist for many years called Irv Kupcinet, affectionately known as Cup. And Cup had a segment, regular segment on the Channel 2 News called Cup's World. And he would, you know, cover entertainment that was going on in the city because that's what he did in his column. He was kind of a gossip entertainment column. And, you know, he had been in Chicago for decades and you know, he knew all the stars and things like that. And he was big friends with Jackie Gleason. So I got wind that Cup was going to interview Jackie Gleason. I heard about it in the hallways, you know, Cup's going to interview Jackie Gleason today. So I said to the woman who was, my supervisor, I said, look, I said, you know, she knew I was a big Jackie Gleason. I talked about it. I had little pictures around my desk of Jackie Gleason. Because at that time, the lost episodes had just been released to the public. Jackie Gleason had some old Honeymooner episodes before it became a regular series that were taken from his variety shows. And he had those all in vaults, and the Honeymooners were experiencing a renaissance in the mid-80s. And Jackie wisely played on that and released them. So there was a lot of honeymooner, buzz in the entertainment world, in the zeitgeist at that time. And so then there I was at Channel 2. So I asked if I could go with Cup to interview with the on the interview with him. And she said, yeah, go ahead. Sure. You know, don't make sure you don't get in the way, but you can go. And so I actually met Jackie Gleason, and he died a year and a half later. I certainly probably would not have met him if not for that. It's one of the high points of my life. Sadly, it was a time before cell phones. I didn't have a phone with me. I mean, I didn't have a camera with me, but I did. I was able to get his autograph on a picture, and it says, "To Jim, Jackie Gleason," and I remember talking to him for about 15 minutes. I actually got to his suite before Cup did, and so I knocked on the door, and his wife answered, and she let me in, and there was Jackie Gleason, and I had to I had to sort of be the official spokesman for Channel 2 before Cup came. I had to entertain him before Cup came. So it was just me and Jackie and his wife in his suite at the Ritz-Carlton for about 15 minutes. So what a thrill that was. But as I said, the other major news story that broke, in addition to the Bears that year, was in January of 1986. And I will never forget this, because in our planning office, we were not in the actual newsroom. We were just off the newsroom, just down the hallway from the newsroom, because we were not breaking news, right? So we were in the our own office, but but everybody came in our office because we had a lot of the background files that the writers and the reporters would need in terms of information on different stories, or especially if there was something in the past that they wanted to get some background on. We had all those files. We also took care of those files. And in our office, we also had three small televisions that sat on those filing cabinets. I don't even know if offices have filing cabinets anymore, but back in the 80s, this was long before the internet, long before personal computers. I was still using an electric typewriter in that office. We had still had electric typewriters and phones with dials and cords on them, okay? It wasn't that long ago, but it seems like it was 100 years ago. But yeah, so it was still in those days. And so we had three televisions that sat on top of the file cabinets against this other wall across from where we sat. And they were small black and white sets. They, you know, once again, a black and white set. Think about that, right? Does that even exist anymore? Small, they were probably, you know, not even, you know, maybe 13-inch. Smaller than most of our computer screens that we have here on our laptops. But we had all three major networks on there just to watch what was going on. We didn't have the volume up because it would be distracting, because those TVs were on all day. But we just had them on, and you'd look up just to see what's the competition doing, especially if there was a breaking story. Hey, you know, wait, Channel 7 just broke in with something. Should we break in? Or, hey, we're going with this. Well, no one else is. Well, it doesn't matter. We think it's important. So you'd always keep your eye on the competition. And so I just remember on that January morning, I remember, you know, because I used to, one of my jobs, in addition to, you know, setting up stories, one of my jobs was to go through the newspapers on a daily basis and, you know, clip out all relevant stories of what was breaking or what I thought was newsworthy or I thought we would need for our files for that day, as well as on those files we would have for months and years to come. So I was one reason I got my internship, according to the woman that hired me for it, was when I went to my interview, I said, I'm a news junkie. And I don't even know what the carpet in my room looks like, because my room is filled with newspapers and magazines. And she was like, okay, that's the kind of person I need. I need someone that likes news, that's interested in news, that is up on the news and devours news and lives news. And that's what I was as a teenager, And even before that, as I said, I always wanted to be in the media. So I was, at a young age, was just always, I've been reading newspapers before I even knew how to read. You know, it's been that many years. I've always read a newspaper every day. Several, in fact. And so so that was my job. So I was up on the news. So I knew, while the majority of people, as I said, we were getting very blasé about a space shuttle launch, even though this one did have a little more excitement to it because of Christa McAuliffe as part of it, it still was kind of like, whatever. I don't even think it was shown live. On the news. That's how it just became kind of whatever. And maybe they would show it on the newscast later, but they weren't going to break into the news, into the all-important soap operas of the day to show this. I mean, they weren't going to break into, you know, All My Children and General Hospital just to show a space shuttle launch, you know. Not in those days, especially not in the 80s. That's when soap operas really hit their zenith, you know, the whole All My Children, General Hospital years. The whole Luke and Laura, All My Children, you know, days. So there was no, I don't believe it was shown live, at least not here in Chicago. I really don't think it was. But anyway, so I was aware that the space show was going up. But as I said, we didn't really pay attention to it. Oh, whatever. And so that morning, we were always busy in our office. The whole news, obviously, in a news operation, you're always busy. It's always, you know, hectic because there's always something happening. There's always a fire. There's always something going on. If there's not something breaking, then you're working on a story for that evening. I mean, don't forget, you know, we got to work about 8 o'clock, and the first newscast was at 4:30. So those reporters were out and about by, you know, 9 o'clock. They were out in the field filming the stories to come back, and then. You know, edit them and write them and get them ready for the 4:30 and 5 o'clock and 10 o'clock news. So it was a very hectic day. It was a full day. There was no lollygagging there. I didn't get paid a cent, and I worked 12-hour days, and I loved every minute of it. I actually paid for it because I paid for my parking to go downtown, and I paid for the college credit. So I actually paid them. But as I said, what I got back in experience was invaluable. But yeah, I used to put in 12-hour days there because that was I didn't have any classes because my internship that during that period were my classes. So I was there from like 8 in the morning many times till 8 at night. No lie. So that day was a usual hectic day, as it always was. There were three of us in the office. And, you know, we were just hammering away doing what we do. And I remember, for some reason, looking up at the TVs. I would frequently just glance at the TVs. You know, they were always on. And when I looked up at the TV, I noticed that Dan Rather was on. Now, don't forget, I told you, we had the three TVs on, to CBS, NBC, and ABC, but no volume. So I looked up, and I saw Dan Rather. And I was like, why is Dan Rather on at this time of the morning? You know, it was like 9 or 10 o'clock. And I'm like, well, why is Dan Rather on? You know, this he's on at 4 in the afternoon. Or, the you know, why is he on now? And so I turned around and said to the other people in the office, I said, why is Dan Rather on right now? Because we didn't, you know, we didn't see any footage yet. We just saw Dan Rather. He was talking, but we didn't have the volume up. And so we kind of looked, and I said, you know, there is a space shuttle that went up today, but I don't think they're televising it, are they? So I went and turned on the volume, and we heard Dan Rather say that the Challenger had just exploded. And wow. Knock you over with a feather, right? Here we are. We had conquered space. These things were not even newsworthy anymore, but now it suddenly was. And so the three of us ran into the newsroom. And the newsroom was huge. And as I said, it was always busy, always noisy. You heard typewriters clanking, you heard people yelling, you heard you know, people walking around, just a general scuttle of voices. You know, everybody was talking because there was people working and discussing and get me this and how do I get that. So there was always this constant chatter you heard, not too loud, but it was just always there, except when they were on the air. Then once they, you know, on 4:30, then the news people in the newsroom had to be quiet because, you know, they were talking, you know, they were broadcasting from the newsroom. But during the day, you know, from 8 a.m. until, you know, the news was being broadcast, there was this certain level of chatter, and there would be some screaming going on, and, you know, it was a newsroom just like you see on television. Although today newsrooms are quiet because everybody's on a computer or what. But back in those days, you heard typewriters clanging, you heard people talking, you heard people walking. It was a beehive of activity. It was never quiet. It was never calm. There was always a sense of energy in that newsroom because there was always something happening. There was a fire happening. There was a police this. There was something going on, right? So we run into the studio, and in the main studio or the main newsroom, which was a studio too, they had, once again, huge, bigger news or televisions that were high up. And there was about 6 or 7 of them, I believe, that covered all the stations. At that time, cable news was just beginning. So that was there too. And we walked in, and for the first time since I was there, now I'd been there since September, this was January, late January, for the first time I walked in there and you could hear a pin drop. You could hear a pin drop on a shag carpet. Everyone in the newsroom was standing, facing those television stations, those television sets, and watching the replay of the launch and the explosion. And what was interesting about that explosion was, if you've ever watched a launch, you know that, you know, it there's that initial liftoff, the initial thrust of the rocket, and then once it's airborne, it kicks into another gear, if you will. And then the engines fire, and a lot of times things fly off the sides, and then it starts to really pick up steam. So there's the initial lift, and then when it's at a certain point to get out of the atmosphere, they put it into overdrive and really kick in those engines. And that's when it really starts to, you see a big, you know, burst, and, you know, it really starts to take off. So if you remember the way a space shuttle took off, it was helped initially by two big rocket boosters, because the space shuttle was kind of its own. It flew on its own, but it didn't have enough power initially to get out of the atmosphere. So it needed these huge boosters that it was connected to, and they all lifted off. And then when it got to a certain point, then it could take off, but it needed this initial lift, this initial thrust, this initial boost by two basically giant tanks filled with gasoline, if you want to make it, bring it down to layman's terms. I mean, it was sitting there on two big accelerants that it needed to get out of the atmosphere. And so when it first took off, you know, there was great excitement. The families were there. This was, again, a more of a special thing, too, because of Krista McAuliffe. Her parents were there. They were shown watching it as it flew up into the sky. The takeoff was fine. There was some question. It was delayed a couple of days. There was bad weather. For Florida, it was amazing and crazy. This was an early morning takeoff. There was a frost in Florida, so much so that the orange crop was in danger. And there it was in the morning in Florida, it was like in the 30s, which is unheard of. And as you see in this Netflix documentary, these O-rings, which wound up being the major malfunction, had a history of not performing well when they were exposed to cold weather. And this was a known fact. And yet, the launch was still allowed to go forward in sub-freezing temperatures. In fact, it was so cold, there were icicles initially hanging from the space shuttle and the boosters and the entire rocket that was going to be launched. There were icicles hanging. It was so cold. And yet they let this launch go on. So what was even more catastrophic or more harrowing was when this exploded, when it first exploded, it exploded because it started to go into that next gear, and that's when the rockets could not handle that added pressure, that added burst, and these O-rings broke and there was an explosion. But initially, because we're so used to seeing things fly off of the rockets, and when that happened, when the explosion happened, people were kind of cheering because they thought that that was a good thing, until they saw the contrails and they were sort of going in different directions. It was no longer going straight. It was going kind of sideways and then down. And then it was very clear that that was an explosion and that was not just a part of the trajectory of the rocket. And I remember standing in that newsroom, watching the replay of that and seeing that explosion, now knowing in retrospect that that was the explosion. That was the moment when it blew up. And there had to have been a couple of hundred people in that newsroom. It was still and quiet. Everybody was watching the footage. Everybody gasped when they saw that explosion. It was shown, I think, maybe three times. We watched it. They showed it again. They showed it again. And after the third time, I'll never forget this, it was the third time that we stood there in shock and in sadness and in awe of what just happened, and not a good kind of awe, that we saw that explosion, and it was dead silent, not a word, everybody just gazing and just kind of processing and digesting what they were seeing, and the realities that these seven astronauts were clearly dead, and that this thing exploded, and that something that we had taken for granted now was a major tragedy. But then, after the third time we watched that, it was almost unsaid. It was almost like you didn't even realize it, but it was now our job to report on this. We couldn't sit back anymore and watch this and be sad. We had to get into a new gear. This was our job now. This is what we did. We reported on this. And so we had to get back to work. And as quickly as the newsroom drew silent, it burst immediately into a cacophony of screaming and activity. And it became that beehive again. And people were like, calling out things. We got to get this. We got to get that. Someone called Jim Lovell, the astronaut. He lives, in the Chicago area, on the North Shore. Someone called Jim Lovell. He was involved in Apollo 13, and he was an astronaut who still lives here in the Chicago area. Somebody called Jim Lovell. I had to go. My job was to go and find a model. Like a model you put together, like a car model, a model of the space shuttle, of that, whatever this space shuttle, design was, to go find a model of that because they wanted to make a model to have on the news set for 4:30. So that was my job in the morning. I had to run out. I had to go and find a hobby shop that had a model of that model of the space shuttle and go out and get it and bring it back, and then someone put it together. I had a lot of other duties that day, but that was one of the things I did. And sure enough, someone did make the model, and I was watching the news later that night going, hey, that's the model I bought. So it was an amazing, it was a sad time. It was a harrowing time, but then it was also an exhilarating time to be in a news room, in a news gathering organization, when a major news event, and in this case, a major tragedy, had taken place. And so I will never forget where I was on January 28th, 1986, because not only did I see the space shuttle crash, but I was involved in helping people learn about it. And for, once again, a budding journalist, you couldn't have asked for anything more. So I don't know if you remember that day. I certainly have an amazing memory of where I was. It was a very sad day in our history. When you watch this Netflix documentary, it does a great job of giving the background as well as the behind the scenes with the astronauts, and then behind the scenes with NASA and the developers of the space shuttle. It does a great job. It really puts it into context, into perspective. And it will get you angry. I'm not going to spoil it too much, but it will get you angry when you see that human life was not as valued as much as it should have been over getting the mission accomplished, which it wasn't anyway. Another good lesson, that always keep your eye on the prize, what's most important in what you do, and don't be afraid to speak up when you know something's wrong, because ultimately that shuttle was launched because people were afraid to speak up. People were afraid. They were covering their butts as opposed to saying no. And that's when you get in trouble. When you don't speak up, and when you compromise your ideals, or when you compromise what you know is right because of fear. It's not easy. But if you look at reality and look at the bigger picture, in this case, lives could have been saved. And that's a lesson that you can learn in your own life on a daily basis when you see something wrong. It's easy to keep back and not say anything and just let it be. It's harder to stand up and raise your hand and go against the tide. But if you feel that what you're standing up for is right and is important, it could turn out to save the day, and many times save a life. Watch Challenger, The Final Flight on Netflix. It's a great documentary, and it's a good way to either learn about or remember an important part in our history. Yes, history was before your time. Doesn't mean you can't learn it.
And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com. And don't forget to tell your friends. Send them a link. Send them a message that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and why isn't it theirs? Your loyalty and your devotion is much appreciated, as always. I hope you enjoyed episode 227. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen. Houston, we have a problem.